blockade is an obvious thing to do to the Iranians. So why wouldn't you do it from the very beginning?
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, a Bulwark contributor. And I'm rejoined by my partner in all things strategery, back from a sojourn in Donald Trump's least favorite NATO ally, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, welcome home from grandparent leave.
Yes, well, the bad news is, the Spanish government's incredibly hostile. By the way, Pedro Sanchez, complete sleazeball. His wife was just indicted on corruption charges. My Spanish son-in-law tells me that he thinks actually a lot of the anti-Trump and anti-Israel stuff is purely intended as camouflage to try to keep him in power. So there's that. But the good news is I have a beautiful new granddaughter, and my daughter's fine, and my son-in-law is adjusting, and all is good.
Mazel tov.
By the way, I have to tell you, I picked up some stray voltage while I was away, I think on Twitter or it's one of these stupid comment columns, which said, very interesting that they've kind of kept Elliot off Shield of the Republic. Still appearing in the Atlantic. What are some of the deeper machinations going on? There are just so many idiots out there. Speaking of idiots, let's talk about the jackasseries of the week. I know you have your candidates. If I could begin,
please,
and understand, I'm coming from the land of the Inquisition. We were there during Semana Santa, Holy Week, and you see these guys, everybody. Parading in the as Nazarenos, so these are penitents. I mean, to the uneducated American eye, that you go, "Oh my God, it's the Klan," but it's not the Klan. It's quite different significance. But it did get me thinking, and I have so many wonderful Christian friends who, unfortunately, quite frequently have to say, we really feel for you Jews. Everybody's trying to kill you. Everybody hates you. We love you, but there are a lot of people who really don't and just want to slit your throats. So I want to return the favor and extend my condolences to all my Christian friends for the blaspheming that has been going on with Donald Trump sending out these revolting pictures of him as Jesus. And they say, "Oh no, I was just a doctor." And then of course, taking on the Pope, joined by J.D. Vance, who having been a Catholic for, I think, 7 years, now thinks he's in a good
is it that long?
If it's that long, to give Pope Leo lectures on theology. So I would say the president and the vice president, to my mind, are the jackasses of the week, or certainly have committed jackasseries. I can't look into their souls to know that they're simply jackasses, although I have my suspicions.
They certainly, are up there in the pantheon this week. We may have to retire dunking on Secretary Hegseth because he's been a winner for so many weeks. But honestly, going public at a press briefing I lose track because there's so much. But in a public forum, I think it might have been a religious service actually at the Pentagon, which raises questions in and of itself. But he talked about the so-called CSAR prayer for those who were awaiting search and rescue. And in it, quoting what he appears to believe is a quotation from Ezekiel, but which bears a very uncanny, very uncanny likeness to the speech that Samuel L. Jackson gives in Pulp Fiction as he's about to execute, a criminal rival. I mean, you can't make it up.
You can't make it up. But by the way, but that speech, which was outrageous, as so many of his speeches are, and we should keep on dunking on him because he so richly deserves it. I think in a way, which is really unprecedented, is, you know, whenever he gets up there, he begins talking about Jesus and his particular brand of evangelical Christianity. And, you know, that is not what American public figures do, because, among other things, that leaves out agnostics, atheists, Jews, Hindus, Muslims, I mean, a whole bunch of people. And he has no trouble imposing his religious views into the public sphere as a public official, as private, you know, person. You can do whatever you want. And it's outrageous. And I wish more people would call him out on it. But no, I don't want you to feel in any way inhibited for calling him out for jackassery. I think he, as long as he's in office, he deserves everything he gets.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because we talk a lot about civil-military relations, and because it occurred while you were gone, the firing of Randy George, chief of staff of the Army, and I know General George a little bit, not real well, but I know him well enough to know that he is an outstanding officer, and I think was doing a very important job of what he called, you know, transformation in contact for the Army, trying to bring the Army into the modern, you know, modern battle space that we're seeing emerge both in the war in Ukraine and now in the war in Iran. And I mean, firing him for literally but no cause given.
I was going to say they didn't give a cause.
But reputedly, it's because Hegseth was holding up the general officer promotions for several female and black officers. I mean, you know, does this ring a bell? I mean, this is so persistent, and it apparently is the tip of the iceberg, because there are other services whose promotion lists he's holding up, apparently on similar grounds. You know, this is using DEI and anti-wokeism as a cloak, in my view, for out and out misogyny and racism.
Yeah, I agree with that. In some ways, it's, I think the other piece of it is apparently he wants to make his chief of staff of the Army a guy who, I think he'd been his personal aide or something like that.
He'd been his mill aide, senior mill aide.
And so there's, you know, there's this element of favoritism to it. If there's a faint silver lining in this, it's clear he wants to get rid of Army Secretary Dan Driscoll, because everybody knows that he's the heir apparent whenever Trump gets sick of Hegseth. And I think Driscoll actually outmaneuvered him by saying, I have no intention of resigning. I love this job. I'm going to keep at it. Driscoll stood up for George. And then I thought very interesting, if you look there, I guess there were some hearings in the House where both Republicans and Democrats were standing up for George, because everybody I know who knows George, I don't know him, I don't think I've even ever met him, but everybody says exactly what you said, an outstanding officer who's doing a terrific job. And even the Republicans were saying, this is ridiculous. So you have that, but it's worrisome. The larger question, I suppose, for us to think about a little bit is, how much damage can this guy do to norms of civil military relations, where the military are just, they're just professionals. You know, the fact that they work for the previous guy doesn't make a difference unless there's something in their actual conduct that should make a difference. I do worry about what Hegseth can end up doing, first at the very senior ranks, because look, you know, generals, my view is generals are human beings. There's a normal distributional curve. There are many, I would say there are more straight arrows, you know, down the line by the book types. But you have the sycophants and suck-ups and courtiers as well. And the question is how many of those he will promote and how that corrupts the senior officer corps. And then, of course, there's the effect of the things he's done further down. And that's actually should be quite worrisome to us. You know, what he does, what this has done to the culture of NCOs and junior officers who don't know any better and who can kind of fall in line with this. I mean, at the bare minimum, I would say what this means is when you get a different kind of administration, God willing, in 3 years, there'll be a lot of repair work to reestablish norms.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me not to think back, you know, from my own experience to the You know, look, the transition from the Clinton administration to the Bush 43 administration was pretty fraught.
Yep.
Given the disputed election of 2000, the Supreme Court case and all that. And yet, you know, when you think back on it, you know, the late Don Rumsfeld, when he was Secretary of Defense, asked Rudy De Leon, the deputy secretary, to please stay on while Paul Wolfowitz awaited confirmation. Paul did not get confirmed in my recollection. Don't hold me to this exactly, but I think it was maybe March or April. It might have been around this time. So there were several months there where Rudy was acting as deputy secretary, and Rumsfeld tried to get him to stay on in some other capacity after Paul was confirmed, because he understood Rudy was a great public servant.
Absolutely.
You know, had been a very effective, I mean, he'd been chief of staff of the House Armed Services Committee, he'd been very effective deputy. And you know, Rumsfeld saw that and wanted to make use of it for the nation. So this, you know, this spirit of let's get after the deep state, let's crush all our political opponents, is, you know, so deleterious to the national interest.
And it's even worse when you begin doing that to the uniformed military.
Yeah.
You know,
my point was that was for civilians, but, you know, people's prior service and, as in various roles in the Clinton administration, it wasn't held against anybody in the Bush administration. You know, it's doing it in wartime, by the way, also. I mean, even though technically chief of staff of the Army is not directly involved in the war, he's in charge of manning, training, and equipping. It's still, you know, not ideal to have that kind of change in leadership in the middle of a war.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, let's talk about the war. You know, we're taping this just as the Iranians have said the straits are open. Trump has said the blockade is still on. There are negotiations clearly going on. Trump is making noises. Oh, we're going to have a deal in a day or two. So I mean, I just have some initial thoughts. So my overarching thought, which, I mean, you and I have talked about before, and I think we may have a moderate disagreement here, is, my view is the outcome of this is much more mixed than people think. And we probably really won't know the full outcome for, like, quite possibly a year or years. I think, you know, some of this stuff will have a very long tail, like what this has done to the Iranian governing system. It is a second thing that seems to me is, first, it's a real danger that Trump wants to get the hell out of this situation, and so he would cut a truly, truly awful deal. But he may not. I mean, I've come to the conclusion this guy is completely unpredictable, so he may or may not do that. The third thing, which I find very interesting, you and I will talk about Europe in a little bit, but the Europeans are talking about sending in minesweepers and frigates for escort of convoy, both of which we don't have, okay? Like, we have zero frigates, which are sort of smaller warships that you use for the escort of convoy mission, and we have basically blown up our own minesweeping, mine hunting capability. Well, it turns out the Europeans in particular have them. The French, in the very French way, have said that we will do this, but we don't want to have any American participation whatsoever, and the Germans are saying, no, we want the Americans. So, but I think it is interesting that despite the real acrimony between Americans and Europeans over this war, but over much, much more else, I mean, the logic of the situation is the Europeans should be doing this. I mean, it's in profoundly in their interest to have the Straits of Hormuz open. And if it requires that they do the minesweeping and some of the escort of convoy stuff, it makes sense, particularly if there's no real shooting going on. But those are my initial thoughts. What about you?
So let's talk about blockade for a minute, because I think it's very interesting. And you and I have had a bunch of text exchanges back and forth over the 6 weeks of this war about this. So one thing that strikes me is, how did we get to the point where Trump decided to, you know, blockade the Iranian blockade, if you will, or as he put it? Because these are things he could have done right at the outset of the conflict.
And I have no idea why he didn't.
Right. Well, I can tell you why I think he didn't. I think the answer to that is he thought, and maybe this is partly because of what Bibi presented to him in the meeting they had on February 11th before the war started, that this would be over in 4 or 5 days. You know, they would eliminate the leadership. They would find an Iranian Delcy Rodriguez, and everybody would live happily ever after. The fact that they started this with zero minesweeping capability in the theater, because they had essentially retired the Avenger class minesweepers that had been in the region, in the theater, in December. And they had two of the three littoral combat ships, the independent class littoral combat ships that are kitted out with the mine countermeasures capability that the U.S. currently has, which is minimal.
I was going to say, which isn't much.
Two of the three of them were in laid up in Malaysia for modernization. So how you would, you know, launch a war where it was potentially possible that the Iranians could close the strait, which is, as you and I know from our own service and government, something we've been in the government considering, working on, figuring out for 40 years. Certainly since the, you know, the tanker war of the late 80s, you know, the fact that they didn't even put this in, have this in the planning, suggests that they thought they would never face this and that the war would be over before it became an issue. Point one. Point two is, you know, Trump came to this after the failure of the talks in Islamabad to yield an immediate agreement. So clearly he thought he needed more pressure. And although I think he kind of just tumbled into this by happenstance, I don't want to make too much of the fact that John Solomon had a column that Trump posted the day before he announced the blockade saying, oh, the U.S. can always blockade. I'm not sure it was that serendipitous. And the causality may have gone the other way in terms of who talked to John Solomon before he wrote his column. But he was, in a sense, picking up really one of the few tools he had available, right? I mean, what else could he do to try and increase the pressure on Iran if he didn't want to violate the ceasefire and go back to kinetic activity, which I think he didn't want to do for a whole host of reasons, including market reaction and all of that. Now, this makes, you know, some sense because, you know, as you and I, again, in text exchanges have noted, there's some very good work that has been done by, you know, former Treasury analysts about how much this costs the Iranians and how much additional pressure it puts on them. And it's not just the money from lost, you know, oil shipments. It's also the import of food. It's the impact on foreign exchange and the, you know, potential impact on the Iranian currency. It's multifaceted kind of, you know, pressure. By the same token, it also creates some pressure on Trump. You know, if people think this is going to go on and not have a early resolution, which may be why Trump keeps saying we're going to be wrap this up in a couple of days, you know, because he wants to keep the markets, which do react to his tweets, you know, kind of calm. And then there's a third kind of, you know, player here, which is, you know, international community, which is also suffering from all of this, right? So there's kind of multiple pain points, I mean, here that are being, there's a question of who can absorb the most pain for the longest period of time. And I don't know what that length of time is. My thought is it's about 2 weeks on both sides. I think the Iranians are bringing ships into the Gulf to load oil so that they don't, you know, get to the point where they lose all their storage capacity and have to cap wells, which creates all sorts of destruction for their oil infrastructure. I think, you know, the Chinese and others would like to see this wrapped up before this gets to be a problem. So they may be activated here to play a role. And Trump is keeping an eye on the markets because there's huge pain for him politically and economically here. If the price of, by the way, I don't think the price of gas is going to come down that much. If even if we get a deal this weekend, it'll take a while for all of this to unsnarl. There are over 100 tankers in the Gulf. 23 of them right now, by the way, trying to make a break and get out while the getting is good, because nobody knows how long this is going to last. So this is, to me, a kind of, you know, this is Schrodinger's straight, right? It's open and it's not open at the same time.
It's you know, I one of the things that really strikes me about this is you really see the consequences of the absence of planning. So you're going to go through a war. You would think, obviously, you wouldn't be picking the fights you were picking with the Europeans if you're going to need their support, which you did. But even things like, I mean, a blockade is an obvious thing to do to the Iranians, but because of these things. There's a piece in Foreign Affairs, a piece in New Lines magazine, which I thought was very, very good. There were a couple of others where people sort of laying out just how much pressure this puts on the Iranians. So why wouldn't you do it from the very beginning? Or why wouldn't you think, like, if I don't know if you remember, we mined the port of Haiphong during the Vietnam War. And we didn't do it by sailing ships in there and, you know, pushing mines overboard. We did it from the air. I do you mean we no longer have a capability that we had 50 years ago? I mean, if that's the case, then there's a different set of questions that need to be answered. But I don't think there was much. I just don't think there was any real strategic planning in any meaningful sense, which we've talked about before, and it's because of Trump being who he is. I suspect the Israelis expected this to go on for quite a long time, by the way, though. I don't think this is a question of the Israelis. I think they have a very long target deck, and I think their approach to this is somewhat different than ours. I think their view is that if you really take out a lot of the leadership and a lot of the industrial potential, then you really, even if you don't get an overthrow of the regime, then you really reduce Iran as a menace. I think for me, one of the things this will boil down to is, will Trump in any way give way on the idea that the Iranians can charge tolls or, you know, somehow extort money for people using an international seaway? I mean, that would be a calamity. And he's perfectly capable of agreeing to it, you know, if.
But particularly if he gets a cut.
I was going to say, if the Trump organization, you know.
They get to build the toll booths and brand them.
Right. Yeah, that's gold, all of it. I think there's that. But I do think there's an important point here, which is this point about the Iranians suffering pressure as well. I mean, I continue to be as dismayed as I am by the administration. It drives me crazy. Some of the commentary is just idiotic. Like, so, for example, Robert Pape, this political scientist at University of Chicago, says, this has made Iran a world power. No, it has not. That's the most ridiculous thing you could possibly say. Or somewhat more subtly, people say they're immune to pressure. They have unlimited tolerance of pain. Well, some of them do, some of the diehard fanatics. Do I really think the guys were completely corrupt who have, you know, apartments in Paris and London and, you know, billions squirreled away in Dubai? Do I think they have an unlimited capacity for pain? I don't really think so. I think it's complicated. And the truth is, I think we don't really know what's going on the inside.
Of course. But it's so opaque.
It's the last thing I would say is, and I have been talking to some Iranian friends of mine about this, and it seems to be something of a consensus. If there is a break in the regime, it's going to come from the unknown colonel. And it could be somebody who we think is, you know, completely all in the regime, but is just willing to take a different course, maybe purely for personal advantage. And one of them even said to me that Mohammed Kalibaf, who seems to be sort of leading the negotiation, he said, could be him. You can't tell. And I think the thing is, there are so many layers of deception here, so many layers of opacity. The mistake would be to think that you can manipulate who comes out on top. And I agree with you that it's, you know, because it's so much more opaque than Venezuela, quite apart from being a very different country, they are much more at sea.
So a couple of things. One, it's hard to know exactly what's going on in these negotiations, in part because in the past we were able to at least trust the American accounts. I mean, if you go back and look at I was a big critic of the JCPOA, but, you know, to give the Obama administration its due while they were negotiating it, You know, there were no shortage of press briefings given by John Kerry or Wendy Sherman or others, Jake Sullivan, you know, several, who at least were being, you know, honest at, you know, at broad level of what was going on, even if they weren't revealing everything that was going on in negotiations. They weren't lying outright about it. And now you've got both sides that, you know, basically for a variety of reasons are lying about what's been agreed, what hasn't been agreed. It does appear that there is a three-page document of some kind. It's obviously not a full agreement. I think this is a kind of got to be a framework of some kind. I don't think Trump has the patience to, although he may be, according to Lindsey Graham, he's actually personally involved in some of these negotiations by phone. I don't know whether that's with Golubov or who he's talking to, probably Golubov, I assume, but or maybe Araghchi, I don't know. But the sound of it is, to me, going to raise the question at the end of this, was this worth it? You know, to get this outcome, was it worth expending the huge volume of munitions that we've expended? You know, the damage that's been done to allies, to the global supply chain, and in particular, because of the point you raised, Elliot, the fact that the Iranians may have discovered they've got a weapon that's maybe better for them and less dangerous than a nuclear weapon, which is the ability to close the strait at will.
So let me push back a little bit. I mean, I sort of suspend judgment, you know.
I'm not sure either, because I don't know what the shape of the agreement is.
I think the odds are that, I mean, unless, you know, we have the Trump Organization toll booths on the Straits of Hormuz, there are senses in which it will be worth it, and I think you can already see that. First, the Iranians knew that they had a powerful weapon. That's why they built the kind of navy, you know, the IRGC navy that they have, and that's why they invest in all those mines, and that's why they invest in all those cruise missiles. So, you know, part of what I'm thinking is they would have sprung this on us sooner or later. You know, it's the old story. You put a pistol on the table in the first act. Trust me, somebody's going to use it in the third act. So they've been preparing for this. So I don't think the idea is that this suddenly occurred to them. Oh my goodness, we could.
Oh no, know, no, no,
who,
I'm not saying
who knew that the Straits of Hormuz were narrow and that we could.
No, right. No, could, of course. Control
them. So I think that might have happened. I think actually, first, I suspect we did a lot of damage to various aspects of their military industry and, you know, the various other targets. We'll have to find out. Thirdly, it sends a very powerful message in that part of the world that we did this together with the Israelis. And it really, I mean, for anybody who's serious about military affairs, they'll look at what the Israelis did and what we did. And they say, look, Israel is really, in many ways, the strongest power in the Middle East in certain narrow areas, not across the board. That's important. I think the fact that the Iranians managed to pretty thoroughly alienate the Gulf Arab states, that's a good outcome. I think to the extent this incentivizes everybody to begin looking for pipelines across Saudi Arabia and Oman and through Iraq to Syria and so on, that's a good thing. You know, you'll reduce some vulnerabilities. But I think the main thing is, and I hate to say it because, you know, I don't have nice things to say about Donald Trump, it reminds everybody the United States is a superpower, and the president can, even when it's unpopular, unleash an enormous amount of violence. Now, I deplore, you know, the civilization-ending threats and all that. But that's why, and I did want you to do the China tie-in, because you had some thoughts there. I think even vis-a-vis China, you know, I've had conversations with some people say, oh my God, we've used up all these fancy munitions. This will encourage the Chinese. Well, I don't think countries launch World War III because, you know, they look at the stockpiles of Patriot missiles and THAADs and say, okay, now's the time to go. They make a political calculation. And their political calculation now has to take into account that you have a guy who may be willing to use force on a large scale. And you have a Secretary of Defense who's kind of a nut who seems to enjoy unleashing vast amounts of vast amounts of violence. Now, there are downsides there, too. So I don't want to minimize them, and I don't minimize the rundown of the arsenals. But I think on the whole, you know, particularly given what was the alternative and what kind of Iran we'd be looking at in a couple of years, because they weren't going to moderate. I guess I would add one other thing. The disruption of the Iranian elite. You know, one of the points that a number of people have made is, unlike the United States, where, I mean, no offense to our friends who are two stars, you know, you kill a major general, you'll be able to replace him with a major general who's just as good. That's not true in this system. I mean, you first killing the Ayatollah, that's a big deal. But if you remember when, you know, they knocked out Qasem Soleimani, Ismail Khani, his successor, is just not
as good. Yeah. No. I
so those are my thoughts.
Yeah, I take that point. I guess, I mean, look, some of what we're doing here is the glass half empty or is the glass half full.
Yep.
And that's fair enough, given, you know, what we don't know yet. I mean, so one thing I've been worried about all along is, and you and I know this from our time in government, and you certainly know it from the Gulf War air power study that you led, you know, many years ago. You know, BDA is an imprecise science.
Yep.
No pilot comes back saying, "I missed the target. I didn't hit anything." You know, the what's leaking into the press now from the intel community in terms of their assessments. I mean, the looks like the number of launchers that was destroyed was maybe a half, but there's still a half left, which is not an insignificant number.
Yeah, although, let me just step in.
Some of them are buried in tunnels.
But I mean, and we know how the intelligence community works with those things. I mean, one of the things is they don't like, their idea of a kill is it has been blown to smithereens.
Right.
There is something between being blown to smithereens and being totally
fully operational.
Also, I remember your fond feelings about the intelligence community when they leaked, when we were in government.
Yes, I plead guilty to hypocrisy on all scores. But I'm just saying, in as much as we know what the assessment is, you know, there may have been less damage than is being
possibly
broadcast now. Second thing is, and I think this is really important, you know, for all the operational success that the U.S. military has had, and it's been significant, I don't mean to minimize it at all. And it's, the men and women of the armed forces who are doing this are great patriots and doing phenomenal things. The reality is the Israelis have carried a very heavy share of the load here. And in Indo-Pacific, you know, contingency, this is where I worry about the rundown in munitions. They won't be there with us. I mean, they're not going to be fighting China. That's just a reality. And so I think we have to, you know, take that into account, you know, as well. And while I take your point that the Iranians built all this asymmetric capability in order to threaten the Strait, their ability to do it wasn't demonstrated. What they've now demonstrated is something, you know, which is that a small number of mines that may or may not be in the water, I mean, we don't really know. But just the psychological impact that they might be in the water have given them a huge advantage. And I think that's something they understand, that if they're left in place, that is something they can recur to, you know, in the future. It's a weapon that they have that, I mean, if you were sitting in their position, or let me put it this way, I won't put the onus on you. If I were sitting in their position, what I would be saying is, okay, I'm willing to make a bunch of compromises while this crazy son of a bitch is in the White House. Because I'm willing to bet most other American presidents who follow him, including J.D. Vance, won't have the balls to do this, or it won't be crazy enough to do this. And so we just need to get through this period of time while he's there. And I'm willing to make a bunch of compromises on, you know, the nuclear side, because I got something that maybe is even better, which is the, you know, the equivalent of a economic nuclear weapon that I can, you know, not just shut down oil flows, but urea, ammonia, helium, sulfur, things that are absolutely essential for the global supply chain. And people are not going to react the same way to that the way they do to the threat of a nuclear weapon. So I can bide my time. You know, I can keep my stocks. I mean, let's say I give up all the 60% HEU. I'd be willing, if I were sitting in their shoes, I'd say, sure, take it. Because you know what? I got a lot more that's at 5 or 20% that I can, you know, enrich later when this guy's gone and when I've rebuilt my capability.
I mean, this was sort of their calculation on the JCPOA. But I think, look, part of the legacy of this war is massive damage to the Iranian economy and infrastructure and leadership. And what we don't know is how that plays out. My instinct is that actually does play out in some way. No, I agree with you. But of course, what they discovered was a psychological fact, it's not a material fact.
Yeah, but there's one other thing that they've learned, I think, which is in the past, when people have raised the question about, you know, they could close the strait, the U.S. government's answer was, yeah, they could close it for some period of time and we'll open it up. The fact that we've been unwilling to actually go in there and run escort operations, clear mines and open it up, I think tells them something.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it should also lead us to do something in terms of the...
I agree with that, of course.
But look, I mean, here's why, again, I hate to cut Trump any slack. I mean, you and I both remember when you had Quds Force operatives in Iran killing our people, we were not willing to lay a finger on them.
Some of us were.
Some of us were, yes. I mean, present company always excluded.
I think this,
you know, there is a precedent that has been set here, which is a healthy precedent.
I just don't know. I'm just not convinced anybody else would make use of it in the U.S. I mean, the Israelis, maybe. I'm not sure about any other U.S. figure who would do it, but yeah, I could be wrong.
That's a good point. I take that point.
I wanted us to turn to the Chinese angle here, and I think it's important. So I do think part of the calculus for Trump of the blockade was, well, let's get the Chinese involved because they're the biggest beneficiaries for the flow. I mean, the reality is, I mean, to your question, why didn't they do something sooner? I think the answer is easy because he didn't want to raise, you know, gas prices at the pump. And he thought allowing the flow, you know, relieving sanctions on Russia and Iran and letting the oil flow through the Ghost Fleet would keep supply, you know, relatively stable and keep it from going too high. That was the calculus, I think. When he realized that wasn't working, I think the question became, okay, how can I get the Chinese to put some pressure on here? So the blockade was in some sense an effort to activate the Chinese. Oh, by the way, I mean, the Chinese had already been activated to some degree by the Pakistanis in this mediation, right? Munir went to Beijing and came back with this 5-point plan for a ceasefire that, you know, ultimately became more or less the framework of the ceasefire. So the Chinese were already somewhat engaged. Here's why I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword. Well, there are a couple of elements to it. One is, yes, the Chinese have an interest in having this wrap up. The question is, how soon do they have an interest in it wrapping up? And how far are they willing to let this sort of, you know, competition and pain absorption that we were talking about earlier play out in the hope that maybe the U.S. feels it more keenly than they do? They've done a lot to prepare themselves for this. They have, very deep, because they've been worried about the problem of the Strait of Malacca for some time, that we would choke off their energy supply. So they've been busy developing deep stockpiles of this stuff, reserves. So how quickly do they feel the pressure to act? And second, they've got a big, pardon the pun, Trump card, which is they've got a summit with Trump on May 14th that he's been begging them to have. And it's been postponed once because of the war. People in the White House, I'm told, are telling other people we know that there's no chance that it's going to get postponed again. But the threat that the Chinese have is, oh, yes, it will, because we're the hosts. And so we can say, yeah, we're putting it off while the war's going on. So that's one thing. The other thing is, and it's, you've made the point repeatedly, that this has got to be a little bit daunting for the Chinese to see this big display of U.S. precision, you know, and execution of air operations and naval operations at a pretty high level. By the same token, they're going to school on all this. They're studying this very, very deeply. And the blockade, you know, sort of precedent could be put to use by them in, you know, in other circumstances.
I agree with that. I think the Chinese always go to school on us. The Chinese are actually usually surprised by what it turns out we can do. So there can also be a deterrent element in this. So, I mean, they went to school on us after 1991. They were shocked by the first Gulf War. They were shocked, actually, by Bosnia. And, you know, when we hit, I mean,
their embassy by mistake.
Well,
that in Kosovo. You and I know
that it was by mistake. That, you know, their view was, no, they were flying this invisible airplane, which dropped a bomb precisely on a corner of the embassy that was engaged in various nefarious activities. So that must have been deliberate. I think the second Gulf War and so on. So they, you know, again, that cuts a little bit in the other direction. But no, there's no question that they're going to school. Look, you know, maybe a way of closing this out, because we really should talk about Europe.
Yeah.
The thing that strikes me is, particularly and this has always been true, but it's really true in our world, everything is connected to everything else. You know, this is not just the Iran issue, it becomes an Indo-Pacific issue. Or just think of the fact that we're in bed with the Pakistanis. I mean, how many tribes have we tried to disentangle ourselves from these guys who are bad? And it's clear that our strategic interests lie with India, not with Pakistan.
Not to mention the fact that the last, you know, DNI world threat, you know, testimony or report suggested they're developing an intercontinental ballistic missile capability that could be a threat to the United States.
Yeah, well, by the way, just
with a nuclear arsenal bigger than the UK's.
Well, one last thing on that. So Victor Cha has a very good piece in Foreign Affairs, which is saying, look, we've kind of lost the fight to contain the North Korean nuclear menace. And they're going to have ICBMs. And they're going to have a bigger arsenal than France and the UK. And my feeling is, and this is the response that I would make to people who are very critical of this war, the Iranians are trying to develop missiles, A, with a range to the European capitals, and they will eventually have ICBMs if we don't do something to stop them. And those will be pointed at us, and because they already have missiles that can hit Israel. So, you know, do we really want to have a whole bunch of these sort of smaller sized nuclear powers run by crazy regimes that either will actually use these things or will use them as protection for nefarious activities? I don't think so. Well, let's talk about Europe. I mean, you had this very interesting election where J.D. Vance clearly had a very bad week, you know, between the Pope and there he goes. He's stumping for Viktor Orban, and the population of Hungary says, no, actually by like a 3-1 margin, we prefer the guys who wanted to throw Orban out. I think there are a number of interesting angles to this, one of which, I think it's a bit of a rebuff to the pessimists to say, okay, these populist authoritarian regimes, you can never shake them, you know, democratic decay, it's essentially all over, because this was an overwhelming repudiation. And secondly, it is striking that Orban, who I think is a very smart guy, he's a very well-read guy, decided to just concede graciously and get out of the way, which I thought was a very smart move on his part. Now, whether he's planning, you know, to spend his life in exile, possibly in the United States, or
more likely Moscow, where he can be, you know, a benchmate with Assad and what's his name? The former Ukrainian president. They can all just sit there and, you know.
You know, I by the way, I met him, I think when he was in his very early 30s, late 20s or early 30s, when he was the, you know, the champion of the student activists against the
anti-communist, yeah, but I met him actually after he lost office the first time, and it was clear he was a completely cynical, embittered person who, you know, was just driven by one thing, which was getting back into power.
Yeah.
I read his concession a little bit differently. Number one, I think he saw the result was so overwhelming. It would frankly be hard to do what Trump did here in January 6th, 2021. But he also knows that he controls the judiciary. He controls a lot of, there's been so much, you know, state capture of institutions that is basically beholden to him and his party, not to the current government, that he has a lot of tools to screw with Magyar and make life miserable for him.
That's not entirely clear because, I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of the Hungarian basic law, but apparently with a supermajority, which is what they have, they'll be able to do things like purge the constitutional court. And
they have a lot of things they can do. And he's got to worry, I think, about corruption trials that will come after him,
which
may be why he chooses to go into exile. I don't know. But the point is, he has other cards to play, and we'll see how it plays out. I think the really interesting thing that people don't appreciate enough is, first of all, Magyar himself is, you know, not a left-wing personality, even though they tried to depict him as the front for a left-wing coalition. As somebody put it on Twitter, this would be like the equivalent of the Democrats not just running with, you know, Liz Cheney endorsing him, but running with her as their candidate.
Yeah. Hey, not a bad idea.
Yeah, I agree. But not as, you know, he's a center right guy, but very much on the right. He's very conservative. And this is one reason why all the MAGA apologists were saying, oh, well, it was just a personality difference. There's no real difference in policies. The difference is Magyar actually does appear to be committed to rule of law, to reestablishing that, to getting rid of the corruption, you know, and creating real journalism, as he said, not just state propaganda, which, you know, will also end up hurting him because real journalism will, you know, always afflicts, you know, those who are in power. But the way he won, I think, is really, really instructive.
Mm-hmm.
He won despite having no access to the media, you know, to having the deck completely stacked against him. I mean, I think, first of all, the enormity of what he accomplished is, I think, not really registered on people here in the United States. But secondly, the way he did it, which was by going and campaigning
everywhere, you know,
everywhere in the rural areas that were strongholds for Fidesz. He was there 8 or 9, you know, events a day in some of these rural counties in Hungary. And so he, you know, he deserves a lot of credit just for the kind of nuts and bolts, old-fashioned, press-the-flesh politics that he did, which I think, you know, is a lesson that ought to be taken on board by, you know, folks who want to apply those lessons here, you know. Well, don't concede rural areas and say, oh, we're never going to be competitive there anymore.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's also, though, a lesson about what are some of the weaknesses of these corrupt populist authoritarian regimes, because they're not actually effectively fascistic. They're authoritarian and they're corrupt and they're bad. I mean, and it's good to see them lose, but they don't have the same kind of hold, particularly in populations which still have access to the internet. And, you know, and which know that there's a better life and want a better life. And, you know, so the kind of the good liberal inside me says that, you know, that shows it. I have to say, I am delighted at all these crackpot right-wing Americans and pseudo-intellectuals who've kind of nested in Budapest trying to explain things away. But what they're mainly worried about is that the Danube Institute, which is government funded, is probably no longer going to be paying for their nice apartments in a lovely city. And boy, couldn't happen to a nicer bunch. I also think this is, you know, it's not, I doubt that most people in Iowa are paying attention to this, but it is a kick in the teeth for J.D. Vance. It's a kick in the teeth for MAGA. It's a kick in the teeth for CPAC, for all those people. It's great for Ukraine. So this, I think this is really something to absolutely to celebrate. It does. I wonder, one other thing about Magyar's social conservatism, though, I think is also important, which tells us something about our time, that it's not that people are clamoring to go back to, you know, whatever the Hungarian equivalent of the Obama-Biden years would be in terms of social policy or immigration, for example, which is an issue. You know, they have fairly traditional attitudes towards religion and family and things of that kind. And I think that does tell you that's kind of where people are. And, you know, I have always felt that we're in this sort of 20-year-plus crisis that's been going on, where elites have become completely detached from what normal people are like. I mean, one book I think I've recommended already is Christopher Lash wrote a book in the 90s called The Revolt of the Elites, which captures some of that. Now, do I think that in our country, the Democrats will take that lesson? I rather doubt it.
Yeah. We ought to pivot from this to Ukraine. I mean, as you mentioned, Magyar's election means that most likely Hungary will lift its veto on the loan, EU loan to Ukraine, other forms of assistance to Ukraine. That's all to the good. But Ukraine has been doing pretty well on their own. I mean, we're about 4 weeks or so into the Russian spring offensive. And yet, if anything, Russia has probably lost ground on, in terms of territory.
They've literally lost ground to some operations conducted entirely by drones and unmanned ground systems as well, where the Ukrainians are winning. By the way, just again, everything's tied to everything else. One of the ways in which, the Iran war has a very beneficial effect, the connection between Gulf Arab states with lots and lots of money and Ukraine with terrific military technology and willingness to share it, that is a very good thing. And it's something that should worry the Russians.
It is, and it mitigates to some degree the windfall that the Russians have gotten from, the run-up of oil prices and the relief of sanctions, which now has, I guess, lapsed. I guess the Trump administration is not going to renew those waivers. So
yeah, well, they have not. By the way, just on that one, since I'm always kind of grumpy about other commentators on this, I don't know how many people were saying, okay, so he's taking the sanctions, they're giving these waivers to the Russian sanctions, those will never come back on. They came back
right. Yeah, I mean, but there are other things here besides that, I think, that are not positive for the Russians. I mean, so they've got a short-term windfall. It's not even clear they're going to be able to completely get the benefit of that, because not just of the longer-term implication, which is the one you cite of the potential of these defense agreements with the Gulf states that, suggest a kind of longer-range relationship, including significant investment in the Ukrainian defense industrial base, which has, that'll have a long lead time, but it will have very huge implications. And for European defense, by the way.
Yeah.
Particularly as we become less of a reliable supplier, which I want to get to in a minute. But I guess the other thing I would say is the Ukrainian long-range strike campaign against Russia, particularly some of the Baltic oil transport ports, has been significant here as well in keeping Russia from being able to completely maximize the benefit that they did get, the windfall they did get from, increased energy prices. And that long-range strike campaign also has been going after Russian, missile production capability, which will also, I think, lower some of the challenge and threat from Russia to Ukraine. Although just, in the last day or so, the Russians have launched another very large you know, ballistic and cruise missile attack on civilian targets in Ukraine. They still have a lot of capability.
Yeah.
But the balance seems to be shifting a bit.
I think so. Including, by the way, the typical Russian behavior, double tap strikes where, you know, you hit a civilian target, then you wait a little bit, and then you hit again so you get the first responders. That, I mean, one of the statistics, though, that should be very worrisome to the Russians is, I think for the last few months, they've been taking greater casualties than they've been recruiting. And there have been a lot of, you know, one of the people I follow is Paul Gobel, who is always quite interesting.
Terrific.
Yeah. There's, you know, you're seeing more and more cracks with the Russian system, because one of the ways Putin, for example, has gotten through all this is he has these unfunded mandates that he gives to regional governors saying, okay, you have to give bonuses to veterans and stuff like that. And they don't have any money to do that. So what they do is they have to raid the rest of their budget so that, you know, there are no social services for anybody else. So there's more and more discontent. Could we link the, and I, we should do more on Ukraine because it's been, you know, we, I think they've inverted, but we should, yeah.
Before we leave Ukraine, yeah, but maybe the link for that is there was a meeting of the, you know, a Ukraine contact group.
Oh, yeah. Talk about that.
Which Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth elected again not to attend, sending Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Bridge Colby there instead. And Colby basically kind of lectured the Europeans and said, you know, you've got to pick it all up here. You know, we're kind of done. And this, of course, consistent with what J.D. Vance just said this week, that, you know, one of the things he's proudest of is ending U.S. support for Ukraine. I mean, if you look at the numbers in 2025, U.S. support for Ukraine has declined 99%. Europeans have picked up a lot of that slack. European assistance has increased by 59%. And because collectively it was as large or bigger than U.S. assistance, that's kept the Ukrainians kind of pretty much in the fight. I guess, you know, what I expect we might see next is that the so-called PEARL program, which is the prioritized Ukrainian requirements
list,
which NATO has basically undertaken to supply Ukraine with U.S.-made manufacturers. I'm very worried that part of the drawdown of munitions is going to lead the administration, and there's already been talk about this, to say, no, those munitions have to, the priority has to be replenishing our stocks, not aiding Ukraine. And that could cause a bit of a short-term problem for the Ukrainians.
I agree. The one area where it's not clear to me that, that our aid has stopped or even diminished is intelligence sharing. Because,
right,
I mean, these Ukrainian strikes are amazingly precise, and that's testimony to the weapon system, but you got to know where to point it. So I think there's that. By the way, just, you know, when you mentioned Hegseth and Bridge Colby and J.D. Vance, it's not just the substance of the policy, which is stupid, but the tone, which is cocky and arrogant and dismissive and insensitive and, you know, contemptuous even, that is awful. I mean, it is immature. It's completely unnecessary. It's a reflection of the fact that, you know, you have people in charge, and I would include Colby in this, you know, whose demeanor is really that of a kind of a pugnacious and unpleasant 16-year-old male.
You know, it's not in any of the textbooks on alliance management or coalition and maintenance. You know, it's not the way you hold a you know disparate group of allies together. And I do think, you know, look, to be fair, our alliance management skills have deteriorated a lot since the end of the Cold War, in part because we didn't have to. You know, that's a bipartisan.
I mean, Obama was not particularly good at it.
Yeah, I'm going to say that was, I think, I'm trying to make a bipartisan point. I mean, I think, yeah. you know, hectoring the, you know, Brits about Brexit, I'm not sure that helped.
No.
You know, Biden, even though I think a lot of Brits regret it, but, you know, never mind.
Biden, I think, was probably the best of them at it. better than Obama, because, you know, he's very much a creature of the old Cold War. Well, while we're on Europe, can I ask you something, though? You know, it seems to me I've been hearing more and more from Americans who are over there, but also from Europeans, that they really think that even before the Iran war, there was this sort of deeper sense of not just disgust, but, you know, we've had it, and really beginning to move out in a somewhat new direction. And, you know, to which my response is always, yeah, and I completely understand why you would feel that way. And God only knows where we'll be in 3 years, but that the, you know, the bedrock of common values and interests will still hold something together. I'm just curious how you think about that.
Well, broadly, I agree. And God knows the alliance has had, you know, many crises. The transatlantic alliance has had many crises since, I mean, it's been in almost a perpetual state of crisis since the ink was drying on the Washington Treaty in 1949. I mean, you know, we had this initial effort for Europe to generate conventional capability to withstand a Soviet invasion, and which failed utterly. You know, you had Suez, I mean, you had Vietnam, you know, we had differences over the management of the Soviet Union in the tail end of the Cold War. We had, you know, we had the pipeline controversy in the Reagan administration with our allies. You know, this is, it goes on and on, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it goes back to the '50s, actually.
So none of that is new, but I do think this is a little different in the sense that, you know, Trump's threats to invade Greenland, you know, were sufficient to get the Danes. I mean, they took it seriously enough that they were actually prepared to shed blood. So I think that's a threshold I don't know that's ever been crossed before.
Yes, I agree with that.
And I think there's going to be a lot of repair work that needs to be done. Now, where I completely agree with you is I think the logic of the importance of the transatlantic link, both with regard to Russia, but frankly with a lot of other problems that we're facing in the world, whether it's the Middle East or the Indo-Pacific. I mean, the tragedy is before Trump came back in January 25, I think we were actually making some progress on a lot of that.
Yeah.
I think most Europeans were not sorry to see Iran lose a lot of its proxy capability in Lebanon, where the French traditionally been involved, or, you know, the fall of Syria. I mean, you know, all of this was, and growing concern about China. And I think Trump has just stopped all of that in its tracks, you know, and refocused everything on the, you know, the immediate transatlantic relationship, which is in bad shape. Now, look, out of this, you know, in terms of Hegel's cunning of history, can come some good, which is, I mean, you know, the defense industrial base in Europe does need to be, you know, rebuilt and, you know, put into production at scale for the defense of Europe, but more broadly, I would say, because all of these problems, as you say, are interconnected. And the U.S., I mean, if you look at the scale of Chinese productive capability, we've never faced it. We, the U.S., have never faced an adversary with that kind of productive advantage over us. It wasn't true with the Germans during the Second World War. It was not true of the Soviets during the Cold War. And so we need allies, and we're going to need their help. So it's not just a, you know, oh, we're shedding our defense burden, you guys need to pick it up. We all need to be in the boat rowing together on this one, you know, at a higher tempo, I would say, if we want to get ahead of this problem.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it sounds like we're pretty much in the same place. And the problem is we are going to have Trump in power for, you know, something under 3 years. And I have to say, maybe this is kind of lead us into the final discussion. what, apart from all of his other awful qualities, I do think he is getting even more deranged, demented, mentally ill than he was before. I mean, for, you know, for me, one of the latest things is like these, he wants to put up these big triumphal arches everywhere. I mean, that's it, you know, and combined with these really bizarre Jesus memes and stuff like that.
And the Führer bunker he's building in the, the East Wing of the White House.
Just have effect. You're dealing with somebody who really is mentally unwell. And that's not going to get any better, and it's not going to stabilize, because when those things begin to happen to people, as you and I both know, they, the only question is how steep is the trajectory downhill.
I think that on the issue of Europe and Trump and his mental decline, you know, madness, whatever you want to call it, I think the challenge is going to be, and I think we kind of dodged at least one potential problem. When he met with Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, there was a lot of concern, and the White House stoked it that he was going to tell him where he's withdrawing from NATO. Luckily, I think it's going to be harder for him to do that. I don't think he wants to take that on, because it will lead to a conflict with the Congress, which is, you know, there's already two laws on the books that, you know, constrain his ability to do it. You know, one of them arguably, you know, is unconstitutional, and he might want to litigate that, but that'll be in the courts forever. And so I think he's going to continue to threaten, you know, and you know, but I think the challenge for those of us who continue to believe that the transatlantic, you know, link is important is figure out ways to keep the connections at lower levels going, you know, to maintain, you know, the you know, salutary benefits of alliances for the United States. I mean, among other things, he couldn't have prosecuted this campaign, whatever you want to say about the...
Without European bases.
Without European bases. And whatever you want to say about the Europeans not picking up as much, you know, slack as he might have wanted, that he could not have even done what he's done without them. So, you know, and I think so for those of us like you and me who believe in this, I think we, and, you know, Frank Miller and I have been writing a lot of stuff about this. We need to, you know, keep the core of the relationship as a central element of U.S. national security policy kind of alive, so that when we get beyond this period, you know, others can start doing some repair work. But that repair work will be, I would argue, more significant than what Biden encountered when he came back after the first term, and it will take a longer time to kind of completely recuperate from this, because Europeans, understandably, for a variety of reasons, not just Trump, you know, are concerned about the U.S. going its own way.
Yeah, not unreasonable. Well, that's as cheerful as we get.
Pretty much.